see a few pockets of people that ain't acting crazy. Because I'm here live.
Get it back live.
About half of y'all motherfuckers on the hill are doing your thing. Are y'all ready to get live or what?
Get it back live.
We gonna set this off right or what? It's Friday night. We'll see. I'm the cream of the crop. I rise to the top. Give me the pig.
I guess jumping up is a lot like bouncing back, I suppose. that was a little joke. Okay, we'll pretend we're going on the. I'm going to introduce this, and I'll introduce it here. I'll just hit the play button during the show. So I'll do the intro now. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Well, you know. The Toronto Argonauts went through a long spell of not winning Grey Cups. They really did have a moment in history that was the lovable losers. And putting a book together about that team on the cusp of finally winning a championship, the 1983 Argonauts, the boat logo team.
The boat logo, yay, the boat logo. We all love the boat logo.
Exactly. And it's an amazing feat when you think about it, because today in the CFL, there are teams that have not won in a long time. I mean, if I told you that Saskatchewan has not won a Grey Cup in a long time, people might be surprised by the enthusiasm of their fans. But in fact, that is true. Although there are only 8 teams, there does come a time when some teams hit a real dry spell. Your book is about how that dry spell ended and, you know, the reaction of those around it and, of course, the players. Do I have it approximately right? With me is Paul Woods, the author of Bouncing Back, the national joke to Grey Cup champs.
Sorry, Frank. Yes, you've got that right. You've got it right. It's about the journey from a futility to success. From misery to ecstasy, both for the players and for the fans. You know, there's a big chunk of the roster in 1983 that won the Grey Cup who were there in 1981 for the worst season in Argonaut history. So the journey that they went on to turn that around is a remarkable story, and the journey that we as fans got to be there to see it and be part of it was a lot of fun. So it's really for both, yes.
So your book is about the inside moments from management to players to the fans, and starting with the season, getting a flavor and understanding, you know, a touchy-feely on how bad the team was in 81.
Yeah, it covers all 3 seasons in quite a bit of detail, more detail as you get towards the Grey Cup in 83, of course. But there's three fairly extensive and lengthy chapters about 81, about the way that season started, and then the arrival of Ralph Fazio, and then the firing of Willie Wood, and the end of the season. It was a remarkably bad and difficult and in some ways comical season that ended in a record of 2-14, and yet had about 10 or 12 players who were good enough to be on the Grey Cup championship team 2 years later, and who came together in large part as a group because they went through that year in 81.
Yeah, there were some real friendships and camaraderie forged in that year. 81 then, the biggest problem with 81 was the big management shuffle. Some suggest that the firing of Woods might have been not a good move. But regardless, it led to 82. Or is there anything else you want to mention about 81 before we get off 81?
I wouldn't say too much more. I guess the only thing I'd say about 81, and I think we should move into the more successful time, is Willie Wood was not a great head coach. I don't think anybody would argue the opposite. But Willie Wood was in many ways responsible for the team that became a champion 2 years later. He recruited Terry Greer and Cedric Minter. He obtained Condridge Holloway in a trade. He made some extremely good draft choices in 1981 that brought four key members of that team, and he started making trades to get other draft choices that he wasn't around to enjoy, but also helped them rebuild their Canadian talent. In fact, I argue in the book that between 81 and 83, the Argos had the greatest infusion of Canadian talent over a short period of time as any team in Canadian history. They went from the worst Canadian talent in the league in 80 and 81 to by far the best in 83. And a large part of that was thanks to the draft choices that Willie Wood picked up in trades. So he deserves credit for that 83 Grey Cup team, even though he was long gone.
Who are some of those players that you tote so highly in that manner?
Well, I mean, in 81, back in those days, you had what was called a territorial exemption. So before the draft even started, every team was allowed to protect two players from their region. And in 1981, the Argos protected Jan Karinci, who played slot back, fullback, receiver, running back. He was the holder on place kicks. He was the backup punter. He returned punts. He did everything for them. So he was one of their two territorial picks. The other one was Dan Ferroni, an offensive guard, who was going into the Hall of Fame this year and, in my opinion, is the greatest offensive lineman in the history of the Argonauts. Willie Wood drafted in 81 Tom Trefo, who was a starting member of the offensive line in 82 and 83 when the Argos were successful. He drafted Gord Elser, who was a backup linebacker and an extremely key guy on special teams. In 82, they added Willie Wood obtained in 81, but he didn't get to the Argos until 82, Bob Bronk, who was an unbelievably powerful fullback who was like a sixth offensive lineman there protecting the quarterbacks. They drafted Jeff Townsend, who was a starting wide receiver in the 1983 Grey Cup. They drafted Tony Antunovic, who was a starting center in the 1983 Grey Cup. They drafted Calvin Prinster, who became a starting offensive tackle not only in the 83 Grey Cup, but also in 1991 he was still there. They even drafted Chris Schultz back then. He didn't join the Argonauts until 1986 because he was with the Dallas Cowboys for 3 years, but he was drafted in 1982 by the Argonauts. They picked up in trade Don Moen, who's an all-time Argo, one of the greatest linebackers in Argonauts history, came in a trade in 82. In 83, Ralph Sazio engineered a deal to acquire Hank Olisik from the Edmonton Eskimos, and he spent a lot of money to get Hank Olisik, whose punting was a huge factor in them winning the Grey Cup in 1983 and also again in 1991. So there you go. There's about eight or nine Canadians right there who joined the Argos in that span of time. They were massively important in them turning that situation around and winning the Grey Cup in 83.
Yeah, it sounds to me, and maybe because we're concentrating on how good the decisions were, it almost seems as though they didn't make any bad decisions at that time.
Yeah, I guess you're right, Frank. I mean, I suppose if you were to go back and look at every single decision that was made, there might have been some mistakes. I mean, I think, frankly, they did make one mistake, one pretty big mistake that didn't cost them in 83, but might have cost them beyond 83, and that was they let Mouse Davis get away. Mouse Davis was the offensive coordinator in 82, the architect of the run-and-shoot offense, which was miles ahead of its time and is basically very similar to what teams in North America are doing now on both sides of the border. Mouse Davis was the guy who invented, you know, plays where the quarterback and receiver decide on the fly where the ball is going. It's not, you know, a set play. It's like, okay, we're going to see how you're getting covered, and that's where I'm going to throw it. And so both guys have to read it the same way. And the Argos, I think from what I heard from the people I talked to, they basically, Mouse Davis wanted a raise, and he kind of got lowballed, and he walked away and went to the USFL, and they were able to keep the run-and-shoot offense going without him in 83, thanks to the players knowing it incredibly well. But after that, it kind of got watered down, and I think if Mouse had stayed, they would have won more than one Grey Cup in that period of time.
Yeah, he was a brilliant man, and you know, we those of us that were of age of understanding and, you know, comprehending sports casts and sports reporters did understand that everybody was kind of, what the heck is this? Is this going to work? This is like, is this gimmickry? Is this something that actually has a chance to be successful? And when it was, I don't care what anybody says today, I think everybody was surprised how successful it was. It really didn't get a lot of credit, serious credit, when it first came up here, when Mouse brought it up. It really took winning for people to believe that this actually is a great idea.
Well, it took a while to work out properly. The first four games of 82, Bob Pavilovich was hired for the 82 season as the head coach, and he brought in Mouse Davis as the offensive coordinator. And the first four games that year, their offense struggled. I mean, it did not look good, and people were going, you know, they were making jokes about it. They were writing headlines like run and what, or you know, they made jokes about run and shoot. But the fifth game of the year, it suddenly started to work really, really well, and they beat the Edmonton Eskimos, the Grey Cup champions, the four-time Grey Cup champions. They beat them up pretty good. And from that point on, that offense was almost unstoppable, and they finished first place. They had a humongous win in the Eastern Final in 82, and then they got into the Grey Cup against the Eskimos, who were at the end of their dynasty, who weren't going to be denied the final Grey Cup for Hugh Campbell, who was leaving to go to the USFL. And they ran into a terrible weather day, rain and sleet and wind, and just things conspired. They weren't going to win that Grey Cup in 82, unfortunately, but it taught them how to be ready for the Grey Cup the following year. And the run and shoot offense in 82 was a thing to behold. It was for Argo fans who'd seen the Argos through the 70s. We never saw offense like that before. We were an offense that could never do anything through most of the 1970s and early 1980, 81. And all of a sudden, we got an offense that is on fire, that, you know, where it seems like whatever Condor Tolloway wanted to do, it worked.
Yeah, they did a great job. And if I remember correctly, gosh, I'm getting old. If I remember correctly, nobody really thought, no matter how good the Argos were playing, that really a Grey Cup was in the cards. You know, it isn't just that the Argos were the lovable loser. We all witnessed the way the Argos snapped, you know, defeat from the jaws of victory time and time again.
Yeah, there was a fatalism, I think, about being an Argo fan, that you just didn't think it was possible. You didn't believe, you figured something was going to go wrong, and I was part of that. I mean, I loved the team, and I believed that if I cheered hard enough, it would help them win and all of that sort of stuff. But I write in the book that in the 1983 Grey Cup, I was at the game out in Vancouver, and tough game, hard to win. We finally get the lead, 18-17, inside the last 3 minutes. The last 3 minutes took forever. And finally, we're down to 10 seconds on the clock. We're in a punting situation. Hank Olesik punts a huge, high, long kick deep into BC territory. Larry Crawford catches the punt. He starts running, and then he realizes he's going to run out of time, so he races for the sidelines, and he gets out of bounds with 1 second left. 1 second, and they're on their own 25-yard line, so they're 85 yards away from a touchdown. And one of the guys I was there with two buddies, and one of them reached over to shake my hand. And I said, no, I'm not shaking your hand. There's a second left on the clock. It's not over. That's what Argo fans went through. We didn't think it was possible. And I'll never forget, you know, when they won, when that next play, the last play happened and the ball got knocked down and we were champions, I was kind of in stunned disbelief. And I'll never forget, there was an old man. Well, I shouldn't say an old man. There was an older man sitting a couple of rows in front of me, and he was an Argo fan. I was in a little section of Argo supporters up in BC Place, and there weren't many of us there. There was an older guy sitting there, and it was like he was crying, and he's going, they won. they won. Like, he was completely in disbelief over this.
And that was the mantra of the Argo fan here in Toronto. After all, the Argo call is a haunting call, a ghostly call. It is what it fits, you know, the Argo image of back then. You know, people now look at it as a proud thing, but in the old days, it was a way of saying they blew it again.
Argos. Well, that's right. It's funny. There's Terry Greer, who, of course, Terry Greer was the great receiver for the Argonauts in 82, 83, and all the way up to 85, and he was there for 80 and 81, and he told me that, you know, in 80 and 81. He'd be on the subway and he'd hear Argos, and it sounded depressing and negative and sour. And then in 82, when they started winning, and in 83, when they were a really dominant team, he'd hear the exact same Argos, and he thought it sounded great. He just said there was a change in the feel of it because the team was winning.
The inflection.
I don't even know if it was the inflection. It was just more. It was more the psychology of it or something, I think.
Yeah, well, it does have, you know, it's amazing how you can take a word, you know, and make it a call and have that call have a different personality, if you will, dependent on how the person says it. It really, really is like that. And,
sure.
Yeah, you know, the Argos, so then in 81, we've talked about the moves that led to 82 that really turned the team around. And all this time, the team was drawing a lot of people. It's not that they were drawing few people. A lot. There were many and many Argo fans at that time and many CFL fans at that time. 83 starts, and how does it begin? Your view on your research going into the 83 camp, what were we looking at? Did they see the success in their future? Was there that much confidence? Did they believe that this could be the year right from the onset?
Yeah, there was, well, within the team, there was an enormous amount of confidence going into 83. I mean, they felt like we're moving up to the next level. They had tasted success. They'd gotten to the Grey Cup. They'd lost, but they'd seen what it was like to be there. And they had virtually all the players back, or all the key guys were back in from 82 to 83, with one exception, that being Zach Henderson, who was there at the start, but was sort of disappeared fairly early on because of the import ratio. And they had added a piece on offense. You may recall that in the 82 Grey Cup, playing his first game as an Argonaut was a guy named Emmanuel Tolbert, receiver that they put in. He hadn't played all game all year long. He'd been on the practice roster and on the injury list, but they liked his speed and they put him into the Grey Cup, and his first time he touched the ball, he scored an 84-yard touchdown. And so Tolbert was a starter, a full-time starter in 83, and that added one more weapon to that offense, which was already very good. So there was a lot of confidence in 83. The other thing that they added in 83 was Hank Olisik, and I mentioned him earlier as a hugely important factor as a punter. He was also the field goal kicker, and he had some challenges as a field goal kicker in 83, including in the 83 Grey Cup when he missed three, but he was an enormous weapon as a punter. The field position that they got with Hank's punting was a factor all season long. So, yeah, they had a great deal of confidence going into 83, and they rolled out of the gate. They started off 4-0. They won their first four games all pretty handily. Then they lost a couple, but they were 6-2 at midseason, and they went 6-2 in the second half of the season, finished with a record of 12-4, most wins ever by a team in the East Division up till that time in the 16-game schedule. Yeah, they were a confident bunch, and they had a scare in the 83 Eastern Final. They played a 5-win Hamilton Tiger Cats team, and they fell behind 15-1 in the first quarter, and they were behind for most of that game. And I'll tell you, up in the stands, it was like, we cannot lose. We're a dominant team, and we're going to lose to Hamilton. And it looked for most of that game like we were going to lose to Hamilton until an incredible finish in the fourth quarter. I describe it in the book as the greatest playoff game ever. I think it really was. So they went into the Grey Cup at that point, having had to come from behind. But, again, a very confident bunch. Carl Brazley, who joined the team late in the 83 season, about halfway through, a little bit right after Labor Day, I guess, he joined. And he said when he got there, he just sensed that these guys, they knew what winning was about, and they felt they were going to win every time they stepped on the field.
And rightfully so. They ended up winning the Grey Cup, so it's not a surprise that they were that good. A reaction maybe, tell us a bit about a few of the players there, some of the interesting stories maybe with some of the players. I know that the Canadian players, guys like Dan Ferrone and Jan Karinci, they were very proud to be Grey Cup champions. Tell us about them and others that played on that Grey Cup team that we may not know, stuff we may not know about that people will enjoy reading in the book.
Well, there's some interest, lots of interesting stories about guys and about their reactions to things. One story that I heard for the first time, which I really enjoyed, was Cedric Minter's story about winning the Grey Cup and what it meant to him. Cedric Minter was a star running back out of Boise State, recruited by Willie Wood in 1981, the Eastern Division Rookie of the Year that year. And then in 82, he's still playing the running back, but he becomes much more of a hybrid position. He was more of a receiver than a running back, frankly. I think he caught 62 passes in 82, which was unheard of for a running back in those days. And he was the weapon that really made the run and shoot hard to defend against, because he would go in motion and teams wouldn't know quite what to do about him. So they win the Grey Cup in 83, and it's a huge part of due to Cedric Minter. He scored the winning touchdown against Hamilton in the Eastern Final with 27 seconds to go. He scored the winning touchdown against the BC Lions in the Grey Cup with 2 minutes and 30-odd seconds to go. And he was a huge factor. He was also playing out his option. He signed a 3-year contract when he came to Canada, and in his third year, he was hearing that there was an NFL interest in him. So he and the Argos just simply couldn't compete with the money that the NFL was going to offer. So he's playing out his option. And in fact, one of the sad stories is he didn't come back to Toronto for the Grey Cup parade in '83 because he was from out in Idaho, which was near BC. His wife had driven from Toronto to BC to get to the game, and then they just stayed out there. They went back to Idaho, and he missed the parade. But so he signs with the New York Jets. The following season, and he's in training camp with the New York Jets, and he's in his dormitory. As you know, players they live in dormitories during camp. He's up in the dorm, and there's a knock on his door, and it's none other than Mark Gastineau, the famous defensive end. He went on to become a really big star defensive end with the New York Jets. At the time, I don't think Gastineau was all that well known. So Gastineau's knocking on his door and says, "There's a package here for you." So and he says, "Can I open it?" And Minter says, "Yeah, okay, go ahead, open the package." So Gastineau opens the package, and what's in there is 1983 Grey Cup ring. And Mark Gastineau was blown away by this. He was knocked out by this ring. And Cedric Minter didn't, you may know, Frank, that in football there's a tradition that in training camp the rookies have to do crazy things. They have to get up in front of the room and sing their school song. They have to perform skits and all that sort of thing when they're all gathering for a meal. Cedric Minter didn't have to do any of that stuff because he was a pro who had a Grey Cup ring. And then he finished the story by telling me, "I wear my ring every day." He said, we used to talk in that locker room about how we really wanted to win a Grey Cup, and if we won a Grey Cup, we were going to wear that ring every day. I wear my ring every day. That's really cool that a guy 30 years later, who's now a school principal down in Idaho, long since retired from football, played in the NFL with the Jets, he still wears his Grey Cup ring every day.
And there are some really nice Grey Cup rings out there. I've seen a few.
Yeah, and the one from 83, by comparison, is quite small. I mean, there's a funny story in the book where Kelvin Prinster, who was a rookie in 83, said, "That's it? Like, it's supposed to be big. This ring's not that big." And, of course, Kelvin was there in 91 when they won a ring that was probably, about the size of a doorknob or something. But other guys said that they thought the Grey Cup ring was plenty big, and in fact they don't a lot of them don't wear it, partly because they feel they don't want to sort of nick it up and things. It's a nice ring, and in fact there's a picture of the ring on the back cover of my book. But if you were to put it side by side with the 1991 ring or the 2012 Grey Cup ring, it's probably about half the size.
So there's a lot of pride in winning a Grey Cup, and that pride also spreads to American players that come up here in Canada. I talked about Dan Throne and Jan Karinchy, the Bobsey twins. It seems they were connected at the hip. In fact, they were the two poster boys for the Grey Cup championship. Tell us a bit about them and their little personal fraternity they had going on.
Well, the thing that was that I really liked about featuring them in the book was the fact that they're two Toronto kids. Dan's from Oakville, but it's effectively from Toronto, and Jan grew up in Scarborough, and they came up at the same time, 1981, as territorial exemption picks, and by 1983 they were team captains, and there's the two guys that got to carry the cup. I'll never forget the sight of the two of them after Jake Goddard presented the cup to Dan Ferroni in BC Place, and for the first time ever he handed the microphone to Ferroni on TV. And Dan wasn't expecting it, and he just said, you know, I think he said, Toronto, you've waited a long time. Here it is. And he told me later, like, he was in a fog. He had no idea what he even said. He looks dazed. If you watch the footage, he looks dazed. And of course, they were saying that it was really hard to breathe in there that day. Somebody said there wasn't much oxygen in BC Place. But I'll never forget, though, after that all happened, Jan Karinchy and Dan Ferroni went down onto the field at BC Place, and they walked around that stadium showing the Grey Cup to Argo fans in the stands, holding it up, one guy with one handle, the other guy with the other handle, showing that cup to us. And I wanted that picture for the cover of my book, and I tracked down the one picture I wanted that showed that. So the cover of the book shows the two hands, you know, Dan Ferroni's hand with the tape on it and Jan Karinchy's hand, no gloves, they didn't wear gloves back then. Each of them have a hand on the handle of that Grey Cup, and it's a great iconic photo. Like you said, they were poster boys for that, and they were the Toronto kids. You know, they were the two guys from Toronto. And a funny story about the cup coming back to Toronto. They had a team party, and they partied all night, and they were going to fly back the next day. And at the party, Coach Bob Obilovich gave the Grey Cup to Mike Hamilak, an offensive lineman. He started sometimes. He was a backup at times. He was their long snapper on field goals and punts. And Obilovich gave the cup to Mike Hamilak and said, "You look after this tonight." And I think he might have done that because Hamilak was a military police officer before he was a football player. He was a big, strong guy. And so Hamilak kept the cup in his hotel room overnight. And he and his wife had it, you know, they shared it overnight, and then he brings it to the airplane, and he's got it on the airplane. And there's a picture in one of the papers of him strapping the seatbelt onto the Grey Cup on the plane. And all through the ride, you know, and he's thinking, great, I'm the keeper of the cup. And then as they're landing, Obilovich says to him, "Give me that cup. It's going to Ferroni and Karinchy. They're bringing it in because they're Toronto kids." And he says, "You son of a bitch, you're taking that cup away from me now." But he was obviously proud of winning it, and he had a huge role to play in it. And there's a funny story in the book about that plane ride and what happened at the Grey Cup. But I'll leave that one unspoken. Let people buy the book and read the story themselves.
And it's no coincidence we're doing this interview today. That moment 30 years ago, and it is 30 years ago now, and I have a lot of great hair to prove that it did happen that long ago. What a moment it was. Still sticks in the memory of football fans in Toronto. I suppose even football fans in Canada that follow the Toronto Argonauts. And most of all, the Argo management today. They are tomorrow, and this is, of course, recorded. For the show on Wednesday, they will be having a thing downtown where people get to meet some of the players. This team, the 83 team, a couple of players like Jan Karinchy and Dan Ferrone. It's really good. It's really nice to have this memorable moment, isn't it?
Oh, it's fantastic. And the team is doing a great job of making it an accessible event for fans. I mean, you mentioned the thing on Wednesday night at Real Sports Bar. There's going to be an availability with Ferroni and Karinchy and two members of the 2012 Grey Cup champions. They'll have a panel discussion, and fans will be able to ask questions and interact with them. And then on Friday night, of course, the reunion game, the celebration game, the game to honor the 1983 Grey Cup champions against Calgary. They will, of course, be brought out at halftime for a great ceremony, and who knows what's in store, but I bet it's going to be really entertaining and really memorable. And before the game, at 6 o'clock, fans that want to get autographs will be able to do that. They're having an availability with the players from 83. I believe it's at Gate 1. I think the players will be inside Windows Restaurant. I think you can enter through Gate 1, get autographs. I'll be there selling books. You can buy the book. You can go and get the book autographed by all these players that are coming back and coaches and other guys associated with the team. And I think it's going to be a great night. And then I think probably after the game, a bunch of those 83 guys will be congregating, I imagine, at Shoeless Joe's, where there's often a post-game party. I don't know if that's the case this time, but I assume it is. And so lots of chances for fans of the Argonauts to interact with their heroes from 30 years ago.
Yep. And, of course, the boat logo, which we can't stop talking about. One of the greatest logos in sports.
I wouldn't say one of. It's the greatest.
I'm glad we agree.
Yeah.
I guess to conclude our interview today, our teaser for your book, the book Bouncing Back, we are, of course, with Paul Woods, author. The research in doing this book, this won't be in the book. Let's talk a little bit in conclusion here of the book, the research and how much work you did putting this book together and who you met with for how long and how far did you go and all that wonderful stuff.
Yeah, it was about a 14-month project, pretty much full time. I started it, I think, in May of last year. I got the brainwave that I wanted to write this book, and so I started reaching out to players and coaches and others, and started doing the interviews. I interviewed about 4 dozen people altogether, all of the key players that were on the Argonauts back then. Coach Bob Obilovich, Coach Mouse Davis, the family of the late Ralph Sazio, the president. I interviewed coaches from other teams that they played against, Hugh Campbell, who they played against in the 82 Grey Cup, and Adam Rita, who was an offensive coordinator of the BC Lions in the 83 Grey Cup, and Al Bruno of the Tiger Cats, George Brancato of the Rough Riders. I went to see Willie Wood, who is not well. He's unfortunately suffering from dementia, and he doesn't have any real tangible memories of his time in Toronto, I'm sorry to say, but I had a good interview with his son, who was an 11-year-old kid hanging around at Exhibition Stadium every day during the summers of 80 and 81, and had lots of stories. So I went, to British Columbia, I went to New Brunswick, I went to the District of Columbia, I went to Tennessee, to Cleveland, around Ohio, around Ontario and Toronto, Kentucky. I did phone interviews all over North America. Everybody was enthusiastic about participating. Everybody wanted to tell their story. They all feel very fondly about that team. Some of the guys were fantastic in providing research material. I got some tapes of old games from some guys. Some of the photos in the book came from players. One of the players, Steve Delcole, a defensive lineman, his wife, actually, as it turned out, was a freelance photographer back in the early 80s, and she had some tremendously great photos that ended up in the book. And in fact, some of Igel Delcole's photos are showing up this week every day in the Toronto Sun as they're running excerpts from the book. It was an intense process. The book's 85,000 words. I probably have 300 or 400,000 words worth of transcript, of interview transcript, lots of research material that I had to go through. But it was a pleasure to do. I mean, it consumed me for the 14 months. It was intense and challenging at times. It affects your personal life. You don't end up, you're not thinking about anything else at times. All you're thinking about is that book, or you're working on that book. But I'm very happy with the way it turned out. I think it tells a great story, multiple stories that form a great story, and I've had great response from readers, from reviewers, from players who say you've captured it, you've told the story. It was a labor of love, but I'm very happy to say that I think people who pick it up will, who liked that team or who are curious about that team, who weren't even around at the time, will be swept up in the stories and will get a great appreciation for the 3-year period of the Toronto Argonauts, 1981 to 83.
Did you leave anything out that you wish you hadn't included?
I have some stories that didn't make it that were that just because of the space limitations and or else there just wasn't really a natural fit for them. There were some cute anecdotes and some interesting stories. But I wouldn't say that there was anything that I have any regrets about leaving out. It was more a case where I made some editorial decisions that, you know, a particular story didn't really fit or wasn't really essential. But I've got a few things in my notebook that may yet surface on my website. I've got a website for the book, bouncingbackbook.ca, and I've populated that with a whole lot of interesting stuff, including some great video footage of old games and of the parade in 1983. I've got some audio on there from stuff in the past, and I've got audio of interviews I've done with you as well, Frank. And there's lots of cool stuff there, and I think my plan is to keep that website going, even though the book is now done and out for sale. I think the legacy of the 83 Argonauts lives beyond the book, and I'd like to keep adding stuff to the site. And so it may be that I'll open up the notebook and look at some of those transcripts and pop up the odd story in there in the future.
Well, and this leads, I guess, my final question, and it'll be probably one that you won't be able to answer today, but you will eventually have to answer. What's next?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm actually, as a result of writing the book, I'm in discussions with a figure in the Canadian sporting scene who might want me to ghostwrite a book, but to work with him on a book project. I have thought about some additional books relating to the Argonauts, and it's far too early to tell whether I'll achieve them. But I've thought about the idea that that Grey Cup in '83 was great, but it was just the first of six that have happened over the last 30 years. So maybe there's a book in store on the 1991 Argonauts, and then maybe one on the '96-'97, and so on and so forth. That's to be determined, but I do think that the 91 Argonauts would make an incredible book. I mean, that's the John Candy, Bruce McNall, Wayne Gretzky, Rocket Ismail, Pinball Clemens, Matt Dunnigan, Chris Gaines. You know, there was an incredible group of guys with that team. And 89, I think actually, frankly, if I were to do that, it would be like this book. It wouldn't be just 1991. It would be 89, 90, and 91 because there's an interesting transition that occurred there. 89 was the first year in what was then called the Sky Dome. It was the last year of Bob Obilovich and Ralph Sazio as heads of the Argonauts. It was the year that Harry Ornest took over ownership of the team. And it was a disappointing year from the on-field standpoint, as 81 was. 1990 was a year when the offense exploded. That was Don Matthews and the Shootout the Lights offense. And Pinball Clemens ran wild and won the Most Outstanding Player award. The Argos had backup quarterbacks who were throwing for 8 touchdowns a game. Ricky Foggy, I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And then 1991 was the incredible year with the McNall Gretzky Candy Group taking over ownership. Rocket Ismail comes to town on a ridiculously high contract. They win the Grey Cup. It's an amazing story. So that's a possibility, but that's to be determined in the future. Right now, I'm what's in store in the immediate future is I got to sell this book. I've written it. It's out for sale, and I need to make my money back because I spent a lot of money in interviewing and getting it printed and so on. So I would encourage anybody listening to pick up a copy. It's a relatively inexpensive book at $23.99 for the book or $18.99 for the e-book. And I think people who buy it are going to feel they got their money's worth. I've had nothing but compliments from people. A lot of people have said to me, I couldn't put it down. It was just such a good story and so well told that I read the whole thing in 2 days. And that's 85,000 words. That's not easy to do. But it does seem to be a pretty quick read, and I think that's because it's a great story and there's great quotes from the players and so on.
We've gone on so long now, I'll have to have another show day.
Yeah, well, let's do it. I mean, we'll get through this week. This is a busy week for everybody, for me, for the Argonauts, for for you, I'm sure, and it's going to be a fun week. I mean, I think the fans are going to what I've been saying is that Friday night when the Argonaut organization brings back that 83 team is an opportunity for people to finally say thank you to the men of 83 who deserve our thanks. I mean, they broke a 31-year drought, and they won with class and character. And I think we should all be on our feet to cheer for them on Friday night, and I think the people of Toronto will do that, and I think it's going to be a great show, and people are going to come out of there really feeling great about that 83 team. And I hope if they do that and they buy the book, that they'll feel even better.
I am inclined to agree with you, and I hope so wholeheartedly. Thank you for taking the time with me here. I know that it's a long research. I had a suggestion for the book, but you know what? No, you know what? I'll give it to you. The American Experiment. That might be an interesting book as well.
Yeah, it would be an interesting book. There's been one, I think, done about it.
Has there?
It might be in the works. I'm not sure it's been published yet, but I read something. I think a reporter out west, I think with the Vancouver province, is doing one, and he's a good reporter, and I think it's actually going to be a very interesting book. I believe it's being published maybe this fall. I'm not sure.
Do they have a name for it?
I don't remember the name of the book. I think the reporter is Ed Willis, but I can't recall what the book is called. But I saw something about it, and I thought, oh, that's going to be a good read.
Oh, okay. Well, I was kind of hoping you could do it. But you know what? Paul Woods, thank you for taking the time to talk to us here on Candid Frank Live. And the book, again, is called Bouncing Back, From National Joke to Grey Cup Champions, the inside story of the 1983 Toronto Argonauts, and if I may add, the 2 years leading up to that championship season. Paul, thank you for taking the time with us.
Thank you, Frank. Always a pleasure, and I'm glad to do it.
And my pleasure as well.
All right. Take care.
You as well.
Bye-bye.
I think that went okay.
Yeah, it was great. Thanks.
All right, sir.
What time are you playing it tomorrow?
I don't know now because I might have to play it. I might have to play half now and half on Friday.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Because I got a producer who's put together a bunch of stuff. I don't know how he's going to handle me telling him. I said I was going to do a little interview. I was thinking, you know, 15, 20 minutes, but we seem to tend to go on, don't we?
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well,
there's nothing wrong with what we did. I know you always like to have an answer from me immediately. Just let me, I'm looking at here probably 40 minutes we did.
I think so, yeah.
Which is about half a show. More, you know. And tomorrow I got to do CFL and I got to do CIS. They've got but I'll work something out.
Yeah, the only thing I would suggest is that it probably doesn't make a lot of sense to run it on Friday while the game is on, right?
No. I know. You're right.
Your audience will be at the game, I'm afraid. So,
that was a knee-jerk reaction to the situation. Let me think this through and see what I can do with it. I'm sure we'll be able to work something out, and I'll let you know
when I talk
to my producer.
Yeah, I definitely will want to pick up the podcast and listen to it and archive it and so on. So if you could shoot me a link when you know, that'd be great.
I did already.
It'll be that link regardless.
Yes, because I went into the show because I sent it also to my producer to give him the link in advance so that he can post it in BC. To make a long story short.
Regardless of how long of a segment you run on this, what time do you actually go to air? Is it 9?
10 o'clock.
Okay.
10 o'clock our time, right?
10 o'clock on Wednesday night. Yep.
Yeah, and I was waiting for an answer from another guest, so I'm probably now gonna torpedo the guest I called that hasn't answered me yet.
Yeah.
Which will buy me some time there, a few minutes there,
sure.
And we'll see what we can do. All right, and
sure. Well,
this week,
yeah, you can always, you know, I don't know if you have time, but you could edit this down. It doesn't have to run at a full 40, right? So,
you know what? I like the natural feel of an interview.
Yeah.
You know, I always feel it's not like writing a book, right?
Yeah, right.
It's a moment in time. It's a moment in time.
Well, thanks, Frank.
But you're right. That's a good idea. If need be, I can edit it down. Thank you very much. And thanks for reminding me.
Run it in multiple segments. I mean, it doesn't have to go. It doesn't have to all be played this week. Some of it could be carried into next week. I mean, certainly the stuff that talks about the events, we'd want to play that stuff tomorrow. But But the stuff that doesn't refer to anything happening this week could run next week too, right?
Well, we started with talking about the events, didn't we?
Yeah, I think so. And then we sort of came back to it at the end. Yeah.
But at the end of the day,
okay. Well, do whatever. We'll do whatever makes the most sense.
No, keep giving me suggestions. I like your suggestions. I truly do. I mean, there's all the options are there. Friday's out of the question because that's the game day. You're 100% correct.
Yeah.
If I can't get it all in this week, what I'll do is I'll do it once a week. I'll break it into maybe three, four. I'll bring it into three, four shows. 10 minutes, you know, 10 minutes.
10 minutes,
and it'll give you more. It'll get more bang for your buck, and then I'll be able to promo your book each time.
Yeah, that'd be great. That's good. Okay, well, whatever makes the most sense. Do what works for the show. That's the key thing. So.
Yeah, just give me a chance to think on it. You know what I mean?
Okay.
I'm not very good at knee-jerk reactions. I may have them, but I don't stick to them. I really think I should think about it first, you know, and make sure we do the best for the book and you and, you know, because I appreciate you taking the time.
Okay, Frank, we'll talk to you later. Thanks.
Oh, my pleasure. Have a great day.
All right, you too. Bye-bye.
Bye. It's always like that with him. Oh, yeah. Da 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 da.
We're sorry. Your call cannot be completed as dialed. Please hang up and try your call again. Goodbye.
Are you serious?
Hello?
Jaredin?
Yes, he is, but he's busy at the moment. Can I take a message?
It's Frank. Is he going to be busy long, or?
It's Frank. Are you going to be busy long?
Yeah, tell him we're dealing with flood stuff.
Yeah, he's dealing with flood stuff right now.
Oh, no, you guys still worried about that, eh?
Well, now we're putting in a claim against the city, too, so.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, nice.
Woo-hoo! This is what I'm doing with my vacation, Frank. I love it.
I am so sorry to hear that.
Thank you. Yeah.
Okay.
No, apparently we heard news that Toronto City Council passed some kind of motion for compensation, but it's kind of like I think you have to get your foot in the door by submitting a claim, or if you're not on the list, you don't get, you know. So.
Wow.
So this is us getting our foot in the door.
Well, listen. Don't let me interrupt you.
Okay.
Tell Jason.
Do you want to call you back or?
I wanted to talk to Jared about the Tie Cats. How long do you think you'll be? That's why I'm asking.
Oh, you know what? Tops maybe half an hour.
Okay, I'll tell him to call me in half an hour.
Okay.
Perfect. Thank you.
All right, we'll do.
Bye.
Okay. Bye.
always taking care of the fire. I mean, the flooding.
Hi, you've reached the voice mailbox of Ryan Hines. Please leave your name, number, and a brief message, and I'll get back to you as soon as I can. Have a blessed day.
Hey, Ryan, it's Frank, Candid Frank Live, 905-823-6147. Just touching base with you. First of all, congratulations on a nice turnaround. Maybe things will get much better. It'll be real interesting. Looks like a great season for you guys. You can keep up the good work. I hope you're enjoying the new digs. I know you'll enjoy the newer digs even more. Again, 905-823-6147. Thanks. Bye. Hey, Tristan, how's it going?
Good. Who's this?
It's Frank. Candid Frank Live.
Sorry, hold on. Who's this, sir?
Frank, Candid Frank Live, the blog radio show you're on a few times. And you were with me at the Habitat thing. What the hell? Yeah. I'll ask him if he did it on purpose. Well, I won't have to. He won't answer.
Hello?
Hey, it's me again. Did you not want to talk, or?
Oh, no, what's up?
No, I just want to know how you're doing, and congratulations on the good season you're having.
Thanks, man, thanks.
Yeah, no, if we decide to have a little get-together for some of the Argos and ex-Argos that have done some nice things for charity, I wanted to invite you over for a little barbecue. If you're around. If you're not around, I understand. And if you don't have time, I understand again. I just wanted to let you know that I appreciate what you do in the community. And I just wanted to do something to say thank you. That's all.
All right, cool. Yeah, let me know.
Yeah, I will let you know, Tristan. Unfortunately, the boys here in Toronto, they're on the road every weekend. What's your schedule like on the weekends?
I'm in Regina.
Yeah, no. I know you're out in Regina, but you have no reason to come back here, right?
No.
Okay, then it's okay. Belton has some great barbecues out there.
Where is that really?
Belton Johnson.
Okay, I don't know who that is.
He's an ex Saskatchewan Rough Rider, and
he has
a lot of Hamilton guys over there. He used to play for Hamilton as well. He's a happy relocator. He's an American that moved there, and he's really happy to be up in Saskatchewan. He's working there, and he's created a life for himself and all that kind of stuff. You know, there's a lot of opportunities there for you, Tristan, and I hope you get all the opportunities you need, bud. Oh, okay, hung up again. Okay, I'm just going to leave him alone. Enough of that.